brother was intellectually handicapped and was ended up being blind and deaf and in a nursing home. And at the age of 66 last year, he died. Now, I didn't suspect anything, really. I used to visit him every week. Until the sister, he had an epileptic fit, which he often has, and a stroke, and he was gone within 2 hours. What kept him alive was that he would be taken to my mother's bedside in the same nursing home regularly, and they lived for each other, right? He sensed she was there. Anyway, so when I heard that he was semi-conscious, I thought, oh, I'll go and see him tomorrow morning, because Mum had gone through that and survived 24 hours. But then I heard that he passed away within 2 hours, so I went around to see his body. But what made me suspicious is that the sister in charge kept saying, oh, well, he didn't have much of a life, quality of life, did he? And she kept repeating that every time I saw her. He didn't have quality of life, did he? And, you know, for me, I thought he did, really, because he had Mum, he had me, and anyway. And I started sensing that maybe he had a mercy killing from the doctor, you know, because that's what they thought, he didn't have quality of life. So that was my statement. And I kept saying, he slipped away awfully quickly, you know. He ate very well. He looked healthy. The doctor said he was fine for so long. Anyway, that was my suspicion. And then the question I want to ask you is, if you belong to Dying with Dignity, and say I get to the stage where I develop an illness and I'm a member and I want to die with dignity, do you help me?
No, it's a serious question. We are advocates for law reform. We do not advise people on how to kill themselves or whether they ought to kill themselves. That's not our business. So,
what a pity.
Our advice to you is to fill out an advance care directive. My advice to your brother would have been to fill out an advance care directive so that you knew as much as you can predict what his wishes would have been.
Well, he couldn't. He was seriously...
Okay, but you can't...
Intellectually handicapped.
Okay.
Seriously.
Well, now I
want to make a list of those people who want to ask questions. Dorothy, John, John at the back, L, Brian,
James.
Anyone else? Bert? But you can put up your hands during and I'll note your name, alright? Okay, so we begin, Dorothy.
I would like to ask, what is John's definition of dignity?
Yeah. Self-respect.
And what is your definition?
Did I say dignity? Yes. I have to ask you... the purpose of your question, really, is in what way can I enlighten you? I think it comes down to self-esteem. It's obviously a very subjective, individual thing. I don't think you can define it in any objective way. In fact, having just illustrated this, if you put a more charitable interpretation on the sister's remark, it might be that she's trying to spare your feelings. Just saying, look, don't feel too bad about it.
I thought he had a good quality of life.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Is to discuss with your family and your friends, if you want to, what you feel is right for you. And the advanced care directive, some of the more detailed ones, help you decide what is undignified for you. Some people find it immensely undignified to not be able to toilet themselves. Other people think, hey, hope, you know, put me in the shower and turn the hose on me.
Yeah.
They don't care. It's a very individual thing.
Yes.
So the advanced directive helps you go through a range of possible outcomes from don't do anything just let me go, to throw everything at me, if it's anything possible, you know, do everything you can to keep me alive. And somewhere along that spectrum, there are people who would say, I don't want to be ventilated or intubated. Some people would say, if I get pneumonia, don't give me antibiotics, I just want to be carried off. Just keep me warm and comfortable. The key thing is to make your wishes known beforehand, and for you young people, you think it's not going to happen to you. Right? Do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah. He used to love his food. He was healthy looking.
Well,
he wasn't anorexic.
It's a topic that... Sorry, yeah. I don't know your name, but we were talking about earlier about the taboo about talking about death and dying. Doctors have to be encouraged to raise this with their patients well before they're looking like they have to go into a nursing home. But we don't talk about it. It's a forbidden topic. But we should talk about it. That's why we're doing it today.
Okay. John Albert.
Okay. Well, I suppose I have a few statements, so I'll stand up, I guess. One of the things that Richard was talking about was life extension. If you go back far enough, there was some concern over resuscitation, that we would bring people back who were zombies because their souls had already left them. And that was an item of quite some religious concern at its time. You know, another thing when it comes to religious believers and the nature of that belief and how different it is. With Catholics, you know, there are some anthropologists who say, you know, basically the Catholics claim that they worship God and venerate the saints, and it's a fundamentally distinguished thing. But if you talk to anthropologists, they could say, oh, you know, this is a pantheistic God, you know, the saints are basically like God effectively in the way that people relate to it. And I suppose there are a lot of Catholics who are sort of more members of a sports team who identify with that rather than getting into the theological detail. But going back to the Catholic Church, it's mostly monolithic, but there have been a few places where they've blinked. With the Vatican II, they almost endorsed, contraception, and that was sort of basically muzzled by the political machinations of the Vatican at the time. And if you go into nations like Chile, there were your Catholic priests who were into, what was it called, theology...
Liberation
theology. And those ones who were liberation theology were actually rebelling against the mainstream Catholic Church hierarchy. We tend not to see that in Australia because the church is pretty monolithic, but it's also my understanding that in the Netherlands, their version of Catholicism there is very progressive, and that, you know, your individual priest in the Netherlands, they're supposedly Catholic, but their actual views are rather at variance with the Vatican. And I suppose the other thing is saying, you know, what is in the future, what is in store for us? There's two stories that I relate to at the moment. One, that when they tried to put ethics education in Queensland, the church lobby managed to get a whole lot of people to rise up and lobby their politicians and basically muzzle that. Now, more recently in New South Wales, we do have ethics education. There's recently been an inquiry that we've put in a submission towards. And perhaps it is early days to see how the cards will lay. But it is my suspicion, in spite of the fact that a religious minority has tried to, you know, amp up things like they did successfully in Queensland, that has been quite unsuccessful in New South Wales, and the resounding voices from the people of New South Wales is in favour of ethics education in schools, which suggests that the hold of the churches on public policy may in fact be diminishing and reaching a new era. Now, this is my interpretation. I notice whenever you have sort of something happening in law, there's people who vie for what happens. I know the vote against the Republic, you know, I was saying, well, this means that people didn't like the model that the politicians put up. But you have so many right-wingers who say the Australian people resoundingly said no to the Republic. And notice how I can look at the data and see something clear as a bell, and the right-wingers can have their very different interpretations. And we'll have to see how the cards fall with this thing with the ethics. But my suspicion is it'll be very clear that the push by the religious lobby has fallen flat, and maybe that will hearken a positive future. Anyway. Okay, no questions there, but I hope you're looking at me on
that. Okay, John Levesque.
My name is Chandra.
Yes, what?
Chandra, C-H-A-N-D-R-A.
Thanks, Chandra.
Yes, the Northern Territory legislation, which have euthanasia or death, dying with dignity actually became law in the Northern Territory for a few brief months before it was quashed by the federal parliament. Now, this legislation, would this be a template for what you would propose to others who could be brought up in this state?
Yes.
And a second part which goes off from that, Belgium has euthanasia or dying with dignity. Now, I find this extraordinary because Belgium is a country which is about 90% Catholic. Now, what sort of arguments do the legislators, the people, the politicians in Belgium use? This is a country which is 90% Catholic, going totally against the Catholic Church's teaching, bringing the law that makes dying with dignity legal. I find that extraordinary.
Let me respond on the Northern Territory legislation. Yes, it can be a model. As I said at the very start, there are two distinct models. If you set aside Switzerland, which is the simplest and the longest standing one, it just has one line in its penal code that says assisted suicide is okay if it's done for altruistic reasons. That's all it is. And it's not done by a doctor. But it's all reported, and it's been going for 70 years. The two distinct models are the one in America, which is a self-administered medication, and they define it's only for terminally ill people. Terminally ill defined as you've got 6 months to live. It doesn't cover incurably ill people, people with multiple sclerosis or motor neuron disease or all sorts of other things that might be living for another 10 or 20 years. In Europe, there's both those regimes. It covers both terminally ill and incurably ill people. So they're the two models. The bills that have been introduced in Australia, in Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, New South Wales, not in Queensland, Victoria, have all been similar to the Northern Territory Bill and the Oregon Act. They're all based on terminal illness. So, but it's always a debate about how widely the legislation should be cast and a political reality about how many people you can persuade to vote for you in the parliament, that is.
How do they do it
well? I don't know. I've not seen any explanation. That's a good question. But the arguments are certainly the same. We had last year a Belgian doctor, a palliative care doctor, come out, Jan Bernheim, and he's been involved in this whole business for years and years. And all of his talks are about the same kinds of arguments, that dying with dignity will affect palliative care, will harm the vulnerable, will lead to involuntary euthanasia. As I told you guy earlier, there's not much new in the way of argument. It's the same sort of argument again and again. How a very predominantly Catholic country decides, I don't know. It just gives me a bit of hope, that's all.
It might be like the Netherlands, is my suggestion.
It also might be like
Napoleon.
Yeah, but
Netherlands got a strong Protestant thing, yeah.
I know, because I checked it out. No, it's been Catholic. Now, they may not be very observant, but they are Catholic.
Well, they might be not observant like the Netherlands Catholic.
I think there must be some sort of connection in the Benelux countries, Belgium, Netherlands and Luxembourg. There they are, the three of them together. Why hasn't it happened elsewhere? It's interesting that the rate of involuntary euthanasia is higher in countries that don't have assisted legislation, like Italy and Denmark and Sweden. They're the only countries I know of where the figures are available. And they have higher rates than the Netherlands. You notice that Cardinal Pell didn't mention that either. So, good question, John. I don't know what the answer to it is.
Okay, Brian?
Yeah, thanks.
So,
somewhat of a carry on from what you were saying. I'm an atheist, by the way, just to make my position clear. And I'm a member of the Australian Labor Party, and I'm a Catholic. It's a very Catholic branch. Because I tell him, we actually had a papal knight. And he was just saw in Parliament the other day, shaking hands with Bob Carr, who, by the way, is an atheist. and you should thank him in preference to a guy who's a practicing Catholic. Yeah, you work that out. It just shows you that there's something going on there. This debate has arisen at the branch on occasion. Remember, this is majority Catholic branch. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not the only non-believer there. And the fact that this has been debated, and some Catholic practicing Catholic, they take it as what they call, one that was a woman, she's a serious practicing Catholic, and she was thinking of running for Parliament, and I asked her position on it, because I was interested in abortion, you know, and she said, oh, we take that now as a given. You know, that's it. She doesn't want to, because you know that if you arrive at the party meeting, and it has risen once, been over that party over 10 years now, and you know, there is a minority who will really drive with it, but the majority of Catholics don't want to know. The majority of Catholics in the community are far more liberal than an authoritarian church. And I know my local member at the state level there, he's Labour, and he goes to Mass every Sunday apparently, and I asked him about same-sex marriage. And he said he doesn't particularly want to run with it, but as far as he was concerned, he didn't care. You know, he didn't worry him. I mean, Spain, a Catholic country, has got same-sex marriage. France, nominally a Catholic country, has separated the church and state for over 100 years. Even the Irish are becoming disillusioned. I've had some associations of the Catholic Church, I've frankly brought up in a fairly non-believing sort of Church of England Protestant kind of influence in the family, and I've generally found that coming down through the years that it's much easier to move the views and the positions of Catholics in general than it is of Protestants. The real Protestants, not so much the Church of England, they're not the one or the other, but I'm talking about the ones that you have in the United States. They are stuck in their ways. The Catholics, you can move them. They can move, even the church, even the hierarchy, you can move it.
Well, if you could speed up the process, Brian, I'd be very grateful.
When you look over the last, over the last 40 years, I used to be dead set against state aid for Catholic schools. I've come to a conclusion there, it was a good thing, purely and simply because those Catholic schools, when they took state aid, they had to take state laws. Regarding corporal punishment, the sort of curriculum that they did, all the brothers have disappeared from the Catholic schools, and one you might have just one at the head. So we're working on it, and they still need watching, they still need pushing. And I've been saying for over 20 or so years now, our real problem is not so much with the Catholic Church, but it's with the Protestants, the fundamentalist Protestants. I'm not talking about Church of England, they're not there, they're a church you have, then you're not having a church. I think the Protestants, particularly the United States type Protestants, they are basically the problem. I think there's two big issues made of the Catholic. There's too many assumptions made by the people. Making a statement, and we're invited to make statements, and I shall do so with or without your permission. And the fact is they are far more movable than many Protestants. They're probably even far more movable than some humans right now. Thank you.
I think that illustrates the point, and I just make one comment, it backs up John's point, that there's no universal reason why it should happen here and not there. I take your point entirely. In America, the Protestant fundamentalists are as fundamental as the Catholics, but certainly the public campaigns mounted here have been predominantly by the Catholic Church, and secondarily by Right to Life organisations. But yeah, I take point.
People like Christina Kennelly and her position, she's still a Catholic. Maurice Yemmer and his position. If you fight her, and Cardinal Pell, Archbishop Thomas, threatened him with consequences on stem cells. And half his front bench were Catholic, and they all voted against Cardinal Pell. He might just as well have told them to go vote for it.
Okay, we've got other speakers. James, you're next.
Thank you. I'm the first time here. I'm in the IT, I'm just an analyst. I'd like to share experience with you and the lady. My father was in the hospital for 4 months in Jakarta, the best hospital. And on his third day, on his third month, he asked me for all the brothers. He said, I have Canada Catholic, a Tula, one of the United Council for Multi-Nation, Asia, High Cholesterol, you name it, the body, the Harina. So we have all our brothers and sisters in the RM Australia, and they said that you got more knowledge to make a decision for us. I said, okay, fine enough, get one to be, to go for it. I went to see the doctors. Guess what? There were 7 doctors, 1 Christian and 6 Muslims. And I said that I get one to see. The Harina. Tell me. What is this kind of a survival? You ever know? If I tell you 50% chance of survival, then what are you going to do? And I'm going to tell my dad to pull it off. Check all the things you want to go. Too much suffering. Okay? I won't bore you to death how much you need if a patient sits in the hospital and can't move in 3 months, you know what happens.
Yeah.
You have to clean him up.
Head sore.
So painful and everything else. But the point I'm making this is this. In human terms, we always think of absolute truth. Absolute truth from what? Absolute truth from what we see. By the way, sorry, the gentleman, I'm not against euthanasia. I'm not against anybody.
Well,
I'm just putting my experience and sharing with you guys. Because I did not spend a lot of time with my parents, because I am Australian, but the point making is this. They were looking for absolute truth. Absolute truth is that, oh yeah, if the doctor said that he can go, he can die, but we could, what I was looking for was for more greater truth. The greater truth was, I talked to my daddy, my father, said, why do you want to die? You're so strong man, you could resist all sorts of things. No, I just had enough. But the greater truth was, he was not exhibiting enough of his fight for life. He said, just maybe just fight. And you know what? He cried. You know what he said? Are you saying that if I die, you take my own life, you guys will be responsible for that decision? Look, you're all meant to kill you guys. We have this drama talk, you know? Mm. The point is, from my experience, the greater truth was, I could spend a lot of time with my old man, which I never did. Spent 36 years here. And during his suffering, at least there was a chance for me, for all our family to get together to know how pain is, how valuable life is, and how you try very hard, and we also try very hard with saving the money just to keep them alive. And I tell you another joke that I did. The Muslim doctor asked me, and I said, hey, you're serious, the Westerners? You want to kill the old man? What education have you done? My father put you, your father put you up to it. There are truths in every religion, and there are the truths in every personal belief. And really, I'm thankful that he did not have to go through that process. He died peacefully. And while I'm leaving you, I'm smiling, and the lady said that, a brother or something.
Yes.
It's not a nice comment to make, like, you know, you did not have a good life.
Yeah.
Not at all. But I can tell you another thing that is very painful was, Jakarta is the best hospital. Each time you gave him the medicine, we are trustworthy, we believe that the nurse would give him the prescription and let him take the medicine. Guess what happened? They took the medicine and resell it. Because why? I asked my dad, did you take the medicine? And then when I asked for more medication, he said, I'm at the hospital with other medication. But I can tell you. We can tell you. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? In between the absolute truth of saying that, look, I've had enough. Go for it, I want to die. But we have the sense of the greater truth. I'm not saying that I'm against you.
No, it's fine.
I'm saying that there's a greater truth.
I take the point. We should all talk to our family much more than we do.
Mm.
And in your father's case, I would have said it's ultimately his choice.
Yes.
I mean, quite often, the family will be totally, or parts of the family will be totally horrified at the idea that dad or mum wants to die. they say things like, oh, don't talk like that. You know, you're not ready for that. You've got years to go. Well, our belief is that there's only one person who can make that decision, and that's you. And because it affects you more than anybody else. And sure, some relatives might say, that was a dreadful thing to do. You should suffer on and soldier on until the very end. Other people might say, that was a merciful release. Maybe what the person was saying about it.
Okay. Thank you. Sterk, your name?
I'm very sorry, but a few years ago, somebody in the news wanted to be die with administration, but the odd thing was he did not want to become a burden to anyone. Instead, when I get to a certain age, will you give me a needle and I can die? She went sick. She went back to find me. And the thing was that she didn't get to this age. She was quite okay, so I think. And yet, she got her friend to give her a needle. So she died, and she would not affect her children. What she has had to do when you're, when you yourself are in a normal state, and you're looking ahead, you prevent something coming. You're saying, give me a needle on my 90th birthday. What is advice for other people?
The legislation wouldn't allow that, Sturt. The doctors have to confirm that it's your choice and that no one is coercing you or telling you you're a burden and you ought to, for the good of the family, shuffle off. There are a string of conditions that have to be applied by two doctors, and they have to certify that it's your decision, and that you are terminally ill, not just that you think I might get sick later on. So the legislation we're talking about doesn't cover that particular case.
Excuse me again. I'm only going from a news item.
Yep,
I didn't know any. And then I don't know of anyone in that position. I'm only going from the news items.
No, it's a frequent topic of debate.
Yeah.
In Holland now, there is a group of people who are saying there should be medical assistance to help you die if you're over 70 and just feel you're tired of life. That's, you think you've enjoyed all there is to enjoy. You're not necessarily sick, you just don't want to go on in case you do get sick. There's a lot of debate even in the Netherlands now about whether that's a good thing or not, but it's certainly a growing movement there. There are now 100,000 members of the organisation. And there was a woman in Perth some years ago who said she was, I think, 80, and she wasn't sick, but she just said she felt she'd enjoyed as much as she could stand, and that was it, please.
That was a French woman, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But we don't, our movement doesn't deal with that.
Yeah. Did she get away? Did she get her way?
Oh, did she get her way? Yes, sorry, yes, she did.
Did she? right, thank you. Chandra, your turn.
Okay. Now, my question to you, Richard, is how hopeful are you that there will be this law reform in Australia that happens in the northeastern future? In other words,
it's a good right question. I'd have to say New South Wales, no.
Oh.
Well, we're looking at O'Farrell in charge for at least 8 years, wouldn't you say? So, no hope. The best hope is in Tasmania, because there the coalition government of Labor and the Greens have agreed to introduce a dying with dignity bill later on this year, and for the first time a bill will have government support. It's not, certainly not guaranteed by any means, but that's the best hope. There have been bills in South Australia and Western Australia. Normally they're introduced by an independent or a green. The biggest political difficulty in that sense is that neither of the main parties has adopted as a policy assisted dying. The Greens do have it as part of their policy. So, I hope you and I both live long enough to see it, Chandra, but New South Wales, that's a hard case.
Not more than Liberal National Party.
Yeah, Marshall Perrin was a Liberal, and an enlightened Liberal, and it was such a close run thing. They won by one or two votes, and as John said, it was then overturned.
Murray?
Yes. I was just going to ask, in the people opposed to it over the years tried to suggest the alternative, I tend to call things palliative care, but anyway, just relieving suffering and so forth. And the record some time back was very poor. You know, people were dying in very suffering sort of ways. Are you all... In what you do, are you aware of how much that has changed or improved or anything? Are hospital practices generally in Australia much improved on the painfulness of dying and the dignity of the dying within the legal framework? Mm. Is that getting better, or is that just a line that gets pulled out when you want to oppose it?
No, it's a good question. Yes, it's getting better. The mistake is to see palliative care as an alternative to dying with dignity. They're complementary. Palliative care works for about 90% of people, and if that's what you want to do, that's fine by us. You go right ahead, and they do a wonderful job. They not only try and manage and remove as they can the pain, but the mental anguish. A lot of people find the mental suffering to be more than the physical suffering. But the fact is that about 5 to 10% of people who undergo palliative care do not find relief. Sometimes, even if their pain is relieved, they still find it intolerable to be looked after, to be dependent. So it is a long-standing debate, and our opponents would say there's no need for voluntary euthanasia. Palliative care will look after everything. Well, it doesn't, and the palliative care, the honest palliative care doctors, will say it's a great thing, but it doesn't work for everybody. And we're saying there's no price here. If you want to, sorry, I need to add one more thing. The other argument that Cardinal Pell put forward is that it'll hinder spending money on palliative care. The evidence is that it's just the opposite. Oregon spends more on palliative care now after it's introduced the Death with Dignity Act, and they did a. The Economist in London did a ranking of 13 European countries recently in terms of palliative care and health care at the end of life, and the Netherlands and Belgium were up in the top rank. So it is a myth that voluntary euthanasia legislation damages palliative care. It doesn't. And as I say, the two things are complementary, not antagonistic.
Okay, David?
First of all, I'd like to ask to what extent is assisted suicide regarded as a murder or manslaughter and charged it. But the point that I'd like to make is that
I think that probably you ought to concentrate on that status of the Lord's humility, less on the theological side. I don't really think that's important. I mean, we've had the argument about these Catholic countries that are going ahead with euthanasia legislation. And very few people take Cardinal Pell seriously, even among Catholics.
George will be unhappy to learn that.
but I think it's the empirical arguments which are the important ones, and I think you need to give more attention to that. I mean, I just mentioned a number of aspects of that. First of all, despite the fact of Assi and this gentleman from Indonesia were talking about their concern for the old people, we do live in a me generation, and there are an increasing number of grasping people and people going bankrupt who were dear enough to get their hands on their parents' estate. Now, I don't know which way to play that, but it is not a negligible number of people. That is one concern. Another concern is that 20% of the population will at one time have pathological depression. Depression is the great problem of our age. It's something which is growing rather than diminishing. And people who are in a fit of depression might wish for voluntary euthanasia, might when their circumstances change or their moods change or their medication improves, have a quite different conception on that. And I think that's something which has to be faced up to. Another consideration is that I understand that between 15 and 19 year old males, that the greatest cause of death is in fact suicide, and not as one might have thought, vague accidents or anything else. Mm-hmm. And that again indicates the strong psychological element to death, and there's a healthy male. And the last thing is, I had a background as a medical student, and I wouldn't know how to define the circumstances in which I would want to die. Now, short of praying to Mother Mary MacKillop, there are all sorts of other medical miracles around. I mean, I know that that's a much overstated case. But in point of fact, there are new things developing all the time. Many of these degenerative diseases that you mentioned, like motor neurone disease or muscular dystrophy or disseminated sclerosis, and diabetes and other coronary heart disease, there is some prospect of medical improvements over the years. Now, for somebody of my age, it might not happen. It's quite unlikely to happen in my lifetime. But the young people that you're talking about, you know, that ought to be stating the circumstances in which they'd like to opt for voluntary euthanasia, they've got, you know, 60 years ahead. And the embryonic stem cell phenomena gives the prospect of injection into the heart, of injection into the eye, of injection into all of the organs, and as it were, rejuvenating all of these organs. Well, it's not yet. No, it's not yet. But I mean, in 60 years' time, macular degeneration is another thing. I mean, I would rather die than be blind, because, you know, but that's a personal choice. But again, you know, one can't easily define the circumstances of blindness, because blindness is a very complicated thing, and it can be reversible too. You know, a knock on the head can cause blindness, but it can be temporary and one can recover. Another problem is, of course, coma. Now, at one time, coma was a death sentence. Now people can come out of coma. You've got people that have been pronounced dead and they're in their coffin. And as soon as they're in the crematorium, they come to and they've got to their coffin. Now, again, that may not happen all that often, but I mean, these are all practical things for you to consider. And I'm sure you have answers to all of these things, but I really do think, with humility, that you ought to give more attention to them than to what Cardinal Pell is saying about the theological.
You've gone present information, David, nothing else.
Thank you for your wise advice. Would you like me to come back next week and I'll go through all of those? They are all very sensible questions, and I deliberately chose today to just look at two empirical questions that involve you. Have you got 5 minutes? Can I run through those and give you a quick answer?
Maybe we'll invite you again sometime, Richard. I'm sure that's a practical thing to do.
No, go on, answer.
Quick answer. Clinical depression. Yes, the legislation provides safeguards to stop that. If you've broken up with your girlfriend or you've just lost your house in the financial crash of '90, whatever it was, that is not a reason to apply for assisted dying. The doctor will knock you back. A lot of again in the Netherlands, there are far more requests than there are acceptances by doctors. A lot of people ask for it and get refused. About 30 to 40% of them are for people who really don't match the criteria in the safeguards and who are not meeting those essential criteria of being terminally ill or incurably ill, suffering unbearably and continuously without hope of relief. So two doctors have to swear to this. Clinical depression. In some of the legislation, you're obliged to go and consult a psychiatrist. Some of the others, it's if the first doctor thinks it'd be a good idea. That's an argument. Maybe we should have it mandatory. So the depression bit is allowed for in the sense that it's stopped. If you're depressed because you're sad for some reason, that is not sufficient justification to apply for assisted dying. Oh, so you started out with mercy killing. Yeah, sorry, I need to talk a bit about that. Assisted suicide and mercy killing. Yes, that's against the law. And the best illustration of how silly the law is what happens in the UK. The most tragic case has come out of this. Elderly husband kills his wife and then tries to kill himself and mucks it up. Finding the next morning he's still alive. Or he kills his wife and then 3 weeks later walks into the police station and tells them what he's done. And they're obliged to charge him with murder. But in the last 2 or 3 years, there have been about 40 cases like this, and none of them has been prosecuted. The public prosecutor has brought out new guidelines, and being a very good public servant, and I love him for this, being an ex-public servant, he said, I'm not changing the law at all, I'm just putting out new guidelines. And they basically say, if you acted with a compassionate motive, you probably won't be prosecuted. So, but if I can prove or suspect that you're doing this to get Granny's money, then you're in big trouble, as you should be. And if you did that under any other law, you'd be in big trouble, trying to get Granny's money. It's not linked with assisted dying legislation. So mercy killing illustrates the inadequacy of the law. That there are people who kill a loved one to relieve their suffering, but are nevertheless accused of murder. And the clear difference between murder and assisted dying is that murder is done with malevolent intent, and assisted dying is not.
Yes. It could.
And, okay, case in New Zealand recently, Sean Davison helped his mother die. She was a doctor. And they discussed it for a long time. Then he wrote a book about it. And eventually, the police decided to prosecute him. And he was sentenced to, I think, 9 months suspended sentence, sort of house arrest. He lives in South Africa, but he's been sentenced to house arrest in Dunedin. He claims all this. He wrote a book about it. But it's not as if he did anything morally bad, in his view, certainly not. But the law requires him to be punished, and the judge said she had to uphold the sanctity of life. Well, you would have heard from what I said today that my mind is not an absolute principle. But, yeah, so there's that. Greedy people. Clinical depression. males who commit suicide. Yes, again, young males is a tragedy, but it's not covered by assisted dying legislation. You can go out and kill yourself today. If you're terminally ill or incurably ill and you figure you've had enough, you can chuck yourself in front of a bus, or you can jump off a building, or you can drink weed killer or gas yourself. That's all legal. You remember, suicide wasn't legal 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
It's sad that like it would be legal to not only kill yourself but have an impact on others.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. It's violent.
Well, it's not the lady mentoring this question.
Okay. So,
I have three others,
sorry.
Waiting.
yes, that's the tragedy. You can also tell the doctor, I don't want any more treatment. Remove the tubes, just let me be. And the doctor has to do that. That's legally enforceable. Now, you can refuse treatment, but that might mean that you would linger on 3 or 4 weeks. You can stop eating and drinking if you like. Sean Davis's mother tried that, and she lasted for 33 days without eating or drinking. What sort of existence is that? Yeah, well, it seems to me to be absolutely pointless. Why should you have to do that? How to define the circumstances in which you want to die? You said you'd rather be dead than blind.
Well, this is a blindness.
If it was terminal and irreversible.
The question is different.
Yeah, okay. That's your choice. Sure, there may be a miracle tomorrow. I don't know that. There may be a miracle cure. My daughter is a serious diabetic. She probably has a shorter life expectancy than me. I yearn for a serious answer for that. I give a lot of money for that. I would love that to happen. But if she got to the point of saying, I'm going blind, I'm getting emotional, I'm sorry, there are lots of dreadful things happening to you, I'm sure you know.
Mm.
But if she said, I've had enough, I would say, that's fine.
Of course, one of the problems with voluntary euthanasia, involuntary euthanasia, is that I understand that with all legislation, you have to be capable of giving consent. And the problem is, of course, with people aging into the degenerative condition, is that their mind is going at the same time as their body.
Yep.
And by the time they act conscious, quote, that their body is intolerable, they are not deemed to be mentally capable to
That's a tragedy, and they fall outside the assisted dying legislation because that, for that very reason, that they cannot give informed consent.
Okay, can we go on?
Yes.
Is that it?
There's one more.
All right, coma,
vegetative state,
yeah.
Same sort of thing. Yes, there have been a couple of miraculous recoveries where the doctors thought this person would never come to life again. Difficult choice. Yeah, it's a hard thing. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Ian?
Okay. Can I come down the phone?
Yep.
A couple of quick statements.
Very quickly. We've got two more to go.
Okay, well, we mentioned the Director of Public Prosecutions. I don't know whether you meant the previous one, Nicholas Cowdery.
No, I think the UK. No,
the UK. Okay, well, the DCP, Nicholas Cowdery, and Bob Carr, who's also a member, have something in common. They were or are members of Australian Skeptics, and are atheists and humanists, along with the rest of us. So there's perhaps a good connection there, the politicians and...
Cowdery came along to our parliamentary forum last November and gave a very effective speech.
I heard that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, so yeah, he's a good one.
And a bit about suicide. When I was young, there was occasionally a young male farmer would kill himself, and no one knew why, or no one dared say why, but no one mentioned the word homosexuality back in the 50s. And of course, I figured out later that a given percentage of any population is gay. What's anyone know the figure?
Oh, 5%, 10% even.
Is that high?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, a young man in the country who finds himself gay and attracted to other men would be so, have no one to turn to mention to anyone if he ridicules beyond his toleration. So I can only assume that a lot of those suicides were due to people who were gay, which emphasizes the need for us to embrace all natural and safe sexuality in the world. And also regarding suicide, you might know there was a film called The Falling Man about the Twin Towers when they were brought down by the terrorists. there was a video of a man jumping out and falling to the ground, and some researchers years later did some research to try and find out who he was, and one of their theories was that he was dressed like a chef and jumped out of a restaurant floor, so they said it was probably such and such, and they tracked down his relatives and told them, and they were fundamentalist Christians and Catholics, and they believed that suicide was such a crime that they were, their whole family was devastated that he could have jumped out deliberately. It would have been okay. They said, surely he was thrown out by the blast or something like that, but he couldn't possibly have jumped. That would be a terrible crime against God. So there's a need for enlightenment. Yeah. Now, we've heard some praise, or otherwise, the Cardinal's Hell. You may know that in Sydney Atheist, we hired a bus for a big day out and drove around Sydney. And one of the things we pulled up at was the St. Mary's Cathedral, just as George Pell was closing off the mass. And George Pell and his assistant, Bishop Porteous, came and stood out. They rushed outside in order to greet all the churchgoers coming out of the congregation, congratulating on his excellent sermon. So some of us atheists rushed up and joined the queue. And so I shook George Pell's hand and said, "Hello, George, surprise, it's Sydney Atheist." And he said, "Oh, thank you, but I'm a happy believer." Now, finally, the Pope was mentioned several times. Well, I'm so much enamored with the Pope's claim to having sole contact with God that I built a fake Popemobile, as most of you know, in 2008 and drove it around Sydney to make fun of the Pope Benedict before he was coming out here for World Youth Day. And he had a gold telephone. The Pope mannequin in his Popemobile that I built had a big gold telephone and a gold satellite dish on the roof. That was his contact with God. Because his claim to have the only contact with God was just such an obscenity. That was mainly what I was protesting against. And finally, you mentioned ethics teaching. John said there's a parliamentary inquiry on now. And as an ethics teacher, I'm taking an interest in that, primary ethics. And the main religious person speaking on Fred Niles' side submitted to that inquiry that they weren't opposed to children discussing ethics as such, but they wanted to make sure that they'd learnt the biblical definition of right and wrong before they did so.
Yeah, that's right. The right ethics.
And I thought that's exactly our point of view too. We'd like them to learn learn to discuss ethics before the religious people get to them and tell them what good and bad is.
Okay, thank you. And Julian?
Oh, yes. Short comment and short question. I belong to Dying with Dignity, but I was also involved in Exit with Philip Nisky, and I'd love to have the peaceful pill in my cupboard in the bathroom. I would probably live to be 100 years old because I feel so relaxed that at least there was something there if I really needed it. And I have heard of people saying that. And I've also met people who've got the peaceful pill in their bathroom. And I think it's that's the comment I was going to say. Now, the question is, I wrote it down, the Advanced Care Directive, which is, can I put it in my will? And I've forgotten, I think I knew once. And where do I buy, or is it a separate form? That's the question.
Yep, okay. On the Advanced Care Directive, there are lots of different forms. We're studying this at the moment. When you join Dying with Dignity, which I invite you all to do if you haven't, we'll give you an Advanced Care Directive. The one my wife and I have used is about 20 pages long. There are some that are as short as 2 pages. There are some the Benevolent Society recommends some or points you in the direction of. But there's a range of them, and as I say, they get more detailed as you go along.
How much is it to join?
I'll ring you up.
Not much.
Since you can post me one.
Are these membership forms?
These are membership forms. If anyone
Hand them out at the end. I'd like one. Thank you.
Please.
Thank you.
Single membership is $40, family membership $70, concessions cheaper.
Great.
So I'll get the directive from you.
Yes.
Well, I'm a member of you.
Yeah, yeah. Ring up Gabrielle. Ring up our secretary. Ring up our secretary. And she'll
It's not good enough to put in the will, is it?
It doesn't have to be in the will. It'd be very helpful for you to tell your lawyer that you've got one.
Oh,
If you've got one, yes. You do have to make arrangements so that if you are taken off to hospital and you can't communicate, that the hospital knows you've got one.
Okay.
So you should give it to your doctor, give it to your lawyer, give it to whoever is your significant other.
Okay.
Yes.
John, you're the last one.
Okay. All right. As you know, or a lot of you probably know, that my mum passed away recently. And I suppose there were two things that I learned from that process. You know, people have talked about the way they relate to their father, the way they relate to their brother or whatever. And there were some issues that I guess I had with her that had nothing to do with someone passing away. But the combination of someone's decision-making abilities degenerating, at the same time you would say, well, there is a will and there is someone making a decision there. And one of the things that happened with my mother was that, you know, when she was in palliative care, she said, oh, I just want to die in privacy, don't get in touch with any people. And, you know, me, I suppose I have always said, well, if mum wants something, that's what you do, you know. I've never challenged it, I've never questioned it. That is her decision. I wouldn't have gone any further with that, but my girlfriend did actually say, well, hang on, maybe we should actually tell your friends and let them know that you're here. And, but, you know, that is one of the interesting things that can happen, I suppose. There's this bizarre interaction between the fact that, I mean, in a lot of other ways, my mother's decision-making processes, attributes, whatever, I think it was diminishing and it was declining, and that was a bit sad. But this is one of the issues you have. I guess it's a bit different to what you were talking, because, you know, there weren't the complicated issues you had. Yes, she was in palliative care. Yes, these things were happening. That wasn't the issue, but there were some others. But the other thing that I also learned in going through that process is that the palliative care people talk about managing pain. There's a degree to which that is a valid concept, and a degree to which further down the track it's propaganda. Now, if you're in pain and you're not too far down the track, you apply the painkiller and you are lucid. You are there. You are in control of yourself. But further down the track, things do get difficult, and that ideal is no longer able to be realised. You know, basically, either you will be in pain or you will be zoned out. And basically, you will lose the ability to be lucid. Now, for me, I sort of take there, for me, there's a clear boundary line. If my pain can be managed to the point that I am still lucid in a worthwhile way, great. But when they talk about managing pain, and I say this is feeding a bit off what Richard said, there's a difference between being free of pain and also operating in a dignified fashion. I think they are different concepts. And, you know, basically, sure, manage my pain as long as I can be lucid. But once I'm beyond a certain point, that's, for me, I've gone past the why bother point. And I think that boundary line is something that I think the advocates for palliative care do not properly engage with. Yes, at some stage you can manage pain. It's a worthwhile concept in a certain context. Beyond a certain point, that ideal of managing pain, the wheels fall off it, you know? So, you know, that's something to keep in mind. And that element about palliative care was not something that I guess went into detail in Richard's talk, but for me, it's a very, very important concept.
Okay, everybody, that's it. Now remember, we're partying now. Cake, champagne, food.
All right.
Just a minute. Before we thank the speaker, because everyone runs. Food. I said champagne, soft drink, a donation of anywhere between $3 to $5. Not the speaker, but she's got a freebie. And please stay and party.
Okay.
Thank you to the speaker. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was really great. And just move the chairs sideways, but don't pack them up because you need them to sit.